So I would like to begin by thanking the organizers. I had a really good conference. It's really nice to be here for the first time. It's a very, very nice institute. Almost puts the Simon Center at Stony Brook to shame, I would say. Yes, that's been recorded for posterity.
The metric being how much money is it spent?
The quality of the artwork on the walls. So today I'm going to be telling you about some work I've done on quantum quenches in one-dimensional Bose gases, and some insight that perhaps one can draw from this work into a quantum version of the KAM theorem, or at least a quantum version of an analog of the KAM theorem. And this work has been done with two people, both at the University of Amsterdam, of course, we all know John Sebastian Coe in the back row, and the other person was Giuseppe Brandino, a postdoc at the University of Amsterdam. Now, I'm going to be considering two types of quenches, and the two types are what I call integral quenches, and the other type is non-integral quenches. The integral quenches I'll tell you about first very briefly, just to sort of set the scene, because what's interesting for the purposes of this talk are the non-integral quenches. So an integral quench, or what I mean by an integral quench in this case, is, in terms of a one-dimensional Bose gas, is that one prepares the gas in the ground state of a parabolic potential, so as pictured on the left-hand side, and then at time t equals 0, one just releases the parabolic potential. So the gas is then unconfined and it spreads out. Now, I should warn you that these pictures, or at least for any simulations I'll show you, are a little bit misleading because I'm always going to be working in periodic boundary conditions. So this really is a ring, not an infinite line. Now, the reason why this quench is integrable is because after the trap has been released, the model, since this is a one-dimensional Bose gas, the model describing, the Hamiltonian describing its dynamics, is just the good old Lieb-Linegar model. And of course, as you all know, the Lieb-Linegar model is an integrable model. It has a set of non-trivial conserved quantities. And the presence of these conserved quantities should lead to them controlling the post-quench dynamics in some fashion. Now, this quench, of course, this setup that we simulated is not being done idly. It's being inspired by a particular experiment, now almost 9 years old, coming out of David Weiss's group. And this experiment has the name of quantum Newton cradle. And what David Weiss did was that he prepared two counterpropagating clouds of a one-dimensional Bose gas in a sort of a shallow parabolic trap. He created them so that they were counterpropagating, and he let them go. And what I guess he expected to see was that, you know, they would, since they were initially counterpropagating, they would go up the side of the trap, and they would turn around, come back, smash into one another, and then they would just thermalize. But they didn't do that. What happened instead is that they oscillated in the shallow parabolic potential for a large number of times. The clouds just seemed to pass through one another. And what he hypothesized was the cause of this was that this was a consequence of the one-dimensional Bose gases' integrability. These non-trivial conserved quantities in the Lieb-Linegar model were in some way preventing thermalization. Now, one thing to keep in mind in this experiment, of course, since the gas is in a shallow parabolic trap, the model, or the gas, really isn't integrable. The parabolic potential breaks integrability. And it would be good to keep in mind during this talk, what are the consequences of this breaking of integrability? Or another way of saying it, what's the consequences of the model only being quasi-integrable, or only close to being integrable? Now, David Weiss only suggested that in this Nature paper that the conserved charges were controlling, in some fashion, the lack of thermalization in the experiment. This sort of general conjecture was immediately sharpened considerably by, in this paper of Marcus Riggel, Dunko Ruoski, and Maxime Olshani, where they argued that the thermalization of the gas, instead of being controlled by a Gibbs ensemble, was instead controlled by a thermodynamic ensemble that knew about all the conserved quantities of the integral model, namely, well, rather prosaically titled term generalized Gibbs ensemble. And this is something that's been discussed many times at this conference, so there's no need to go into more details, but you see that that the ensemble knows about all the charges and has a set of generalized inverse temperatures. So that's an integral quench. Now I want to consider a non-integral quench, where I start in the same configuration. I imagine preparing the gas in a parabolic potential. But now, instead of at time t equals 0 just removing the parabolic potential, I want to imagine removing the parabolic potential and replacing it with a small cosine potential. And this is non-integral because this is what I would term a non-integral quench, because the cosine potential breaks the integrability. I should say this is also, I mean, this setup that we explored was also strongly motivated by David Weiss. As soon as David Weiss did his initial experiments, he talked about adding little cosine potentials on the bottom of his shallow parabolic trap in order to increase the increase the rate at which he was observing the gas thermalize. Now, so, you know, talking to him, we were inspired to look at this configuration, although he hasn't ever actually managed to realize this particular, do this particular experiment because of other difficulties. But at least this particular quench was experimentally inspired. So the cosine potential breaks integrability. The Liebe-Linegar charges no longer exist. But then you have to ask the question, does now the gas immediately thermalize? Does it have any memory of the fact that it was once close to being integrable? And so another way of asking this question, and where the KM comes in, is there some sort of quantum KM theorem here that tells us that weak integrability breaking doesn't immediately lead to quantum chaoticity or complete ergodicity? So let me remind you or review what the classical KAM theorem tells us. So it tells us that if we have some integral Hamiltonian perturbed very, very weakly, now for just the pure integral classical Hamiltonian, we have all solutions quasi-periodic, and if we choose the correct variables, we can describe these solutions as living on invariant tori, where the invariant tori are characterized by particular frequencies. Now, the content of the KAM theorem is that if we turn on a weak perturbation, that some of these invariant tori, though deformed, survive. The ones that survive satisfy certain non-residency conditions on these frequencies. But basically, sort of the big picture is that it promises a smooth crossover from being classically integral to being classically chaotic. The system, if it's close to integrable, being integrable, has some memory of that integrability. Now, there's an analog, or at least something that exists in the same universe or same ballpark of the KAM theorem, called Nikoroshev estimates. Now, Nikoroshev estimates deal with, well, quantum KAM theorem tells us that only certain trajectories survive having the perturbation, integrability breaking perturbation being added. The Nikoroshev estimates tell us are estimates that apply to all trajectories in the system. They tell us that given an arbitrary trajectory, the deviation of the action variables from their initial values are bounded by the size of the perturbation for exponentially long times, which in a way is good, because the trajectories that survive in the KAM theorem exist as a Cantor set, even though it has finite measure. you never can be quite, if you're an experimentalist, you can never be quite sure that you are on a KM tori. What Nikoroshev tells us, it doesn't really matter because the solution will survive, will be like its integrable counterpart for exponentially long times. Always for, yes, these theorems, but. Yes. In general, both of these theorems, and something that we will, that I will show you later, the more degrees of freedom in the system, the harder your life gets. So these bounds, this, you see that this n is the number of degrees of freedom, as Fabian just noted, that as n grows bigger, these bounds get worse, and this exponential time becomes much smaller. Now, what we've managed to do in the context of this one-dimensional Bose gas is find something analogous to this, certainly not on the same, at all on the same level of mathematical rigor, but we've found analogs to this in that we were able to construct quantities in the post-quench setting of Liebliger in a one-body cosine potential that are nearly conserved. So, yes, Anna.
But you could absorb n, right? If I something else, and it appears also in the time bound, because the same combination appears.
Well, I mean, but epsilon's, of course, but then that affects the strength of the perturbation, so it's, I don't think you gain anything. Epsilon is not some arbitrary number, it's the strength of the perturbation. Yes?
So what does it happen at time longer than that time? Is it simply that you grow smoothly beyond the bound, or that you are close to some integrable trajectory, and then at some time of that order, you jump close to another integrable trajectory?
No. I would assume at a time beyond this bound, this bound on the deviation from your initial condition from the integrable trajectory is just violated. I don't think anything drastic happens at time equals to this. But to be truthful, I'm not sure. Okay. So we were able to construct quantities in this post-quench setting of a gas in a cosine potential that are nearly conserved. And the way we were at least initially able to do so is we were exploiting our ability to compute the time evolution of the gas post-quench. And so here I give you a little movie of such time evolution of the density profile of the gas after being released from the parabolic potential. And so we are able to compute this time evolution of the gas post-quench using a numerical renormalization group that trades on the integrability, or the underlying integrability of the Liebliger model. And so I'm going to briefly describe this numerical renormalization group. So this numerical renormalization group is able to study systems both in equilibrium and out of equilibrium. And it's able to study any system, well, not any system, a wide number of systems that can be represented as some conformal or integrable theory, which in our case, this is just the Liebliger model, together with some perturbation, which in this case is the one-body cosine potential. Now, the way this procedure works is you stick the system in finite volume. It can be, I mean, for our purposes, or for this case, it's a ring, so we have periodic boundary conditions, but in general, it has to be in finite volume, but it could be, you could have open boundary conditions equally well, at least in some cases. For Liebliger, that would not work because of certain technical considerations. So now we put the system in finite volume, and now we exploit our ability, or the fact that the integrable theory, which here I call H known, I call it H known because we know everything about it. One thing we know about it is we know everything exactly about it. The first thing we know about it exactly is the spectrum. And so because the system is in finite volume, the spectrum is discrete, and what we can do is we can order the unperturbed spectrum in ascending values of energy, like sketched here. The other thing that the known Hamiltonian gives us the ability is to write matrix elements of the perturbation, write matrix elements of the perturbation exactly. So if we were looking at some perturbation of conformal field theory, so say like a free boson plus some cosine potential or some multiple numbers of free bosons plus some a generalized sine Gordon, this matrix element would be fairly easy to compute. But with Lieb-Linegar, this matrix element is actually rather involved. And so this is where, in particular, JS comes in with Abacus, which is a set of routines that compute these types of matrix elements in an efficient numerical manner. Part of the procedure is that one reason why it's rather complicated is you have to use the algebraic beta ansatz to compute these matrix elements, and that gets rather involved rather quickly for any system of decent size. So we have the matrix elements, we have the energies, so that means we can form the Hamiltonian matrix. Now, this Hamiltonian matrix is infinite dimensional because even though the system's in finite volume, it's a continuum system, means we have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So what we have to do in order to make the problem tractable in any way, at least numerically tractable, is we have to truncate the spectrum at some point. So we do that, we end up with, yes?
Is it sparse in
some sense? No, not sparse. These matrix elements are generically non-zero. So yeah, I mean, they might have some, for very high energy states, there will be some tail typically, but generically it's not sparse.
And you, in the previous slide, you said the spacing was 1 over R.
Where R is the volume, or the length of the system.
So these are, in essence, one particle states or something?
No, there are many body states.
Then wouldn't it be an exponential in R, or
Okay, yes. Yeah, the level spacing would grow at high as you move up in energy. Would grow, the level spacings would be closer. The low lying states, of course, would be 1/r. It's not so important that the size of the level spacings. What's important is that things are discrete, because obviously this, if we had a continuum of states, you couldn't do anything. So you truncate the energy at some you truncate the states at some energy, and you then have a finite dimensional matrix which you can then just easily diagonalize, extract the spectrum, you can extract the eigenstates, and so you can compute correlation functions, and so it all seems good. But so this method actually works very well for certain simple models, for certain simple perturbed conformal field theories. You don't have to do anything more. In a way, you've done a lot of the work already because you're able to compute the matrix elements exactly, and so that sort of builds in a lot of the strong correlations in any perturbed integral model, and so you can actually do very, very little numerical work and get very good answers with certain models. For more complicated models, which Lieb-Linegar is one, this crude truncation of states above some energy doesn't work so well. And so what one has to do is one has to take into account these states that you just threw away. And the way to do so, or at least one way to do so, is to borrow ideas from Ken Wilson's numerical normalization group as used to study the Kondo model. And so let me just tell you what he did, and then it should be at least imaginable how we adapt his method to our problem. So Ken Wilson had the Kondo problem, which is a problem of a spin impurity interacting with a bath of electrons. Now, the first step in his treatment of this problem was to map the problem to a Kondo lattice. So what this map does is it takes this spin impurity interacting with a bunch of bath of electrons to a spin impurity living on a half line, half infinite line lattice, where it lives on one end. Electrons hop along the lattice, but one of the key feature of these the electron hoppings is that the further you get away from the spin impurity, the smaller the hopping amplitudes are. Now, fortunately, we don't have to. I mean, this is something that he had to do for his problem. We, as you'll see in a sec, we actually begin in something analogous to this case. So once he had this spin impurity living on the end of a half line, he treated the problem iteratively. He truncated his half line lattice to something very, very small. He then diagonalized this very, very small system. Once he diagonalized, he ordered the eigenstates in terms of energy, and he threw away the high energy eigenstates. He then added a site to what to the original truncated problem. He reformed the Hamiltonian in a basis of states formed by the kept eigenstates of the first diagonalization, in his language, tensored in with the site that he just added. He re-diagonalized the problem, reordered the new energy eigenstates in terms of energy, throws away the high energy eigenstates, and then he adds the next site. And he just keeps repeating. And the reason why what he's able to do is he's able to take into account the influence of sites far away from the spin impurity in a way that's numerically manageable. He basically keeps the matrices that he's diagonalizing at each step the same size, which makes everything numerically easy. And the reason why it works in his case is because he has these hopping amplitudes that are decreasing in amplitude. So he, in some sense, he takes into account the most important physics first by including the sites with the strongest hopping, and then he iteratively includes the sites further and further away which have weaker hopping. It's a weaker coupling to the system. So he's doing this in a sensible fashion. He takes into account the most strongly coupled physics first, and then he looks at what's left over. Now, we can do exactly the same. We begin, in some sense, with a half-line lattice, except our half-line lattice lives in is denoted in terms of energy, and each point on the half-line lattice is an eigenstate of the Lieb-linear model. Now, so sort of our map of the Hilbert space is structured in the same way. The most important states are close to the end of the half-line lattice, whereas the higher energy, less important states are up here. And the reason why they are more important and less important is because we're going to be treating a perturbation that is relevant in the RG sense. And if it's relevant in an RG sense, it's not going to mix high energy and the low energy sectors of the theory. It might mix the low energy sector rather strongly. In fact, it will, but it's not going to bring down very, very high energy states and mix them into the low energy states. And so there's a number of examples where we've worked this out, and it works fairly robustly. So now, how do we use this numerical renormalization group to actually get the time evolution of the gas post-quench? The way we do so is we apply the NRG twice. We first apply the NRG to determine the ground state of the gas, this one-dimensional Bose gas, in the confining parabolic potential. So that gives us the ground state. We then apply the NRG to the post-quench Hamiltonian, and we get a large number of the eigenstates of the gas in the cosine potential. Not just the ground state, but a large number. And if we get a large number accurately of the states in the cosine potential, we can then expand out our initial condition in terms of these eigenstates of the gas in the cosine potential.
Mm. This is like the energy, but the MRG, you keep the eigenstates based on the, you know, the eigenvalues of
The reduced density matrix, yes.
And
I mean, it's similar. I mean, both the numerical normalization group and the density matrix normalization group are basically, in some sense, variational wave ansatzes of variational wave functions for the problem. And so, I mean, people have shown how the energy for the quantum impurity problem actually has a matrix product-like structure. So there are equivalences in DMRG. One of the steps of DMRG, the finite volume algorithm, is where you sweep back and forth along the lattice, sort of variationally improving your wave function. There is, at least Ken Wilson's initial NRG did not have that feature, but people have shown that one can include it. And in fact, since we're interested in determining a large number of eigenstates of the gas, not just the ground state, but a large number of eigenstates of the gas in this cosine potential, we use an analogous sweeping procedure to this finite volume algorithm in the DMRG in order to improve the answer.
But the criterion that makes you retain the states is still the energy, not the...
Yes. Yes. Yeah, there's still this ordering, yeah.
So how are you able to deal with the fact that these eccentrics
have
volume one? Or could you do this with DMRG as well?
No. DMRG, energy is much better at getting at least, we're never getting super high energy states. I mean, as I'll show you in the next view graph, we maybe get at best, say, 1,000 of the first. The lowest energy eigenstates of the gas in the trap. Sorry? And DMRG could never target efficiently that many states at once. Sorry?
No, I was just wondering, you're still in the not so many excitations.
It's not super. It's
not,
No. I mean, we'll get. We don't get high and we don't get mid spectrum. So, which ends up constraining the fact that we can only compute so many eigenstates in the cosine potential. We compute these eigenstates because the idea is that we want to expand the initial condition, the initial state in terms of these cosine eigenstates. The fact that we're restricted to not terribly high energies here means that we can't consider really strong quenches in this method. So we apply the energy on both sides of the quench. We expand out the initial condition in terms of the post-quench eigenstates. And if we can do so, then the time evolution is trivial. Okay. So here is just a plot that shows you that one can actually compute a fair number of eigenstates of the gas post-quench. So for a rather weak amplitude of the cosine potential, we can get 1,200 states for 14 particles to 10 to the minus 4 accuracy. And for stronger cosine amplitudes, we get less. We get only 300 states. Now, let me just say, how do we know that we are actually getting these states accurately? Well, we go to the hardcore limit where things map onto free fermions, and so we can do analytic calculations, compare the analytics with the numerics, and that's when I say we get 10 to the minus 4 agreement, that's 10 to the minus 4 agreement between the analytic calculations in the hardcore limit and the numerics done in the same limit. Okay. So, I showed you to sort of start off the motivation for discussing this methodology. I showed you the time evolution of the density profile of the gas in the trap, or in the gas in the cosine potential post release from the trap. So that's one, the density of the gas is one quantity that we can track the time evolution of. We can also track the time evolution of the conserved, or at least the formally conserved quantities of Liebliger post-quench. And so here's the first three non-trivial ones, Q4, Q6, Q8, which I will tell you what those are in the next slide. And you see that, well, they are definitely formally conserved because you see them oscillate. You can also see that we can go out to fairly large times, times longer than, say, you'd be able to do with DMRG. Is one advantage of this approach. And just to say, the how far we can go out is determined by the accuracy at which we can compute these energies. The error, I mean, we basically, you know, there's going to be some error in these energies, and when that error times the time is equal to 2 pi, then we know everything is dephased and we can't trust the time evolution. But that still allows us to go out to fairly long times. So when I show you these time evolution of traces of the charges, I think it would be useful just to describe briefly, even though JS talked about it yesterday, how one actually computes the charges. The charges, if you write down field expressions for the charges, are actually rather horrible. They are polynomials of derivatives of the field. And actually, the higher charges, if you were to represent, if you were to try to actually act with these field representations on the wave functions, trouble ensues, as JS talked about. You would have to do, at least for the higher charges, you'd have to do point splitting procedures. You'd have to regularize these expressions, and it would be a real pain. However, we don't have to do anything like this, because all we have to do is we have to know what the action of the charges is on the Liebliger eigenstates. The Liebliger eigenstates are being used as a computational basis here. The cosine eigenstates of the gas post-quench are being expressed as linear combinations of the eigenstates. Everything is always expressed in terms of these states. So if the action of the charges on these states is simple, then everything that follows is simple, and the action of these charges on these states is simple. Each state, each Liebliger eigenstate, if we have n particles, is described by n rapidities or momenta, and these momenta are basically just solutions of the Beta-Ansatz equations. It doesn't really matter how we get them; they're there. And then the action of the charges are just simply summing up powers of these rapidity. So the momentum is just the sum of the, if it's an n particle gas, it's just the sum of the n rapidities. So they really are like momenta. The energy, the action of the Hamiltonian of the state is just the sum of the rapidity squared, and then the nth charge is just the sum of the rapidities to the nth power. So everything is very, very simple with these charges when acting on the Liebliger eigenstates. So we have this time evolution of these charges, of these formally conserved charges. But what we discovered was that if we took linear combinations of these charges, we could basically create or construct quantities that were basically time invariant, or nearly time invariant. And the more charges that we included in the linear combination, the better the time invariance. So here's a linear combination involving two charges, and if we choose the coefficients correctly, we could get the fluctuations down to, you know, less than 1%. If we added four charges, we cause the fluctuations to decrease by an order of magnitude. Add another four charges, so eight charges in total, we get a decrease of another order of magnitude in the fluctuation of this.
You can sort of ignore the oscillation, then you get something which is.
We can't ignore the oscillation. I mean, the oscillations are everything.
Well, I guess, in other words, they don't oscillate around the entire range of possibilities of what they could be. Right?
When you say the entire range, you mean? I mean, they have some amplitude to the oscillations, which is tied to the energy of the quench.
So let's say you take some sort of time average. Then you might imagine that as the Nekrasov shift, that this time average would remain constant for a long time interval, and eventually it would slowly, with the secular changes in the time average, and it would start to explore other values.
Yes.
So I think what John is trying to say is that there is no secular motion. There's only oscillation around these integrals of motion. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, but this is what the typical observable does after a quench. Yeah, so if you look at the expectation value of any random, I mean, so you choose a local observable, you plot the time evolution, so it will essentially oscillate around some value rather than going all over the place.
Uh-huh.
So in a sense, I think what Robin is saying, so this is the typical behavior of a not special observable.
Okay.
So.
But why the motion is confined? Why do you have this oscillation for any random operator? Because the motion is confined.
If it were to go 10 to infinity, we only have a finite amount of energy in the quench, and that restricts the deviations of the charges. We would need infinite energy in the, or at least accessing really, really high energy states in order to get, which is not certainly impossible. I mean, John Sebastian showed the interaction quench, which was that type of quench that accessed very, very high energy states. But this is not the type of quench we were looking at. The energy is bounded. And of course, the numerical technique we're using to construct this couldn't deal with anything but a finite energy quench. So you might think, okay, we're constructing some quantity that looks conserved. Are we just really reconstructing the post-quench Hamiltonian in this weird basis of the conserved charges? And the fact is, the answer is no, because we can construct, if we use the first n charges, formally conserved charges of Liebling-Integer to construct that first charge, we can then use the next n to construct the next charge, and we see similar behavior. We see that we can construct, we see this, we add charges to this linear combination, the second charge, we again see an exponential decrease in the fluctuations of the charge. So that means we could continue to do this construction, and so we could actually construct an infinite number of nearly conserved charges just by using an ever-increasing, because we begin with an infinite number of the Liebling-Integer charges, and so we can construct an infinite set of linear combinations of such charges that appear to have this, at least have a variation that's very, very small. And you can do a back of the envelope type calculation, and you can see that the fluctuations go exponentially with the number of charges that you use in the linear combination. It also, but you see that you pay a price if L is the system size, so system size gets bigger, this exponential decrease gets a lot slower. And if your post, this omega naught is the frequency of your initial the initial trapping frequency. And so as that gets bigger, this exponential bound gets smaller. Okay. So I should. Of course, all we've done is take linear combinations of the charges and computed the expectation value of this linear combination relative to one initial condition, which isn't terribly exciting. But what we can actually show is that these charges are not just don't have zero or nearly zero time time variation relative to this particular initial condition that we prepared by putting the gas in the trap, in a parabolic trap, but they're actually conserved as operators. And the way you would do this is that you would just basically compute the off-diagonal matrix elements of these linear combinations. And the off-diagonal matrix elements tell you if they're zero, or if they're non-zero, they tell you that this charge really isn't conserved as an operator. But as you can see, that as you increase the number of charges in the linear combination, the off-diagonal matrix elements decrease rapidly. So here's the off-diagonal matrix elements when you just have one charge. With four charges, many of these off-diagonal matrix elements are zeroed out. And then when we have eight charges, we barely see anything. So they're not just conserved relative to this one initial condition. They're actually conserved on at least the low energy Hilbert space. Now, why can no? Because they have I haven't plotted the diagonal matrix elements, which is basically what you're asking, and that's non-trivial. So yeah, they're not. We haven't rediscovered the projectors, but that would actually be projectors are highly, highly non-low. Well, another way of answering that question, why that would be unlikely, projectors are highly, highly non-local operators.
You have a relatively short system, no?
If you look at the diagonal matrix elements, if you want all of them are of the same order, when they're not pinpointed on one, they're not localized. So.
I don't think the system is so small that would be that including the first eight charges would lead you to something that's non-local. But yeah, I would think it would be hard to take some linear combination with a finite number of Lieb-Linegar charges and create a non-local and have a high overlap with the projector operator of an eigenstate.
That becomes worse and worse when n is large. So
yes,
you need to take a larger and larger linear combination.
Yes.
You know, for larger systems. So in some sense, they are.
No. I mean, they're not. These linear combination of charges are not projecting, and we're not rediscovering the projector operator.
No, I agree, but they are not local. Even if the charges are local. Higher charges should contain higher derivatives.
Yes.
So
yes.
If you are just spinning on a local operator by summing over C is over the higher and higher derivatives.
Yeah, but they're still, they're still kind of local. I mean, in fact, you know, what was Fabian calling them? They were ultra local. It was the word he used. So.
Very analogous to the situation in a bilocalization where you have conserved quantities. They bleed out into neighboring sites. Here they're bleeding out into higher values of pi, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah, I think the other analogy that's useful with many body localization is that the perturbation that we're considering, that of the cosine potential, of course, it's not local in space, but it's local in k space. If I had a perturbation that was, let me discuss it in the next slide, but yeah. An exponential decay.
In other words, as you add in more, is AI.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. They fall off. We haven't actually looked at the behavior of the coefficients as a function of n carefully. But yeah, they do get smaller. I'm not sure if I'd want to call it exponential or power law. So, how do we understand because this is all being done numerically up to this point, how do we understand why we can construct these charges that appear nearly time invariant? Now, the fact that we've shown that these charges are nearly time independent, at least irrelevant relative to initial condition, some particular initial condition is something, I will mention this work by Fabian, this is something similar to what Fabian did in this recent work on spinless fermions. But as again, we've been able to, they specifically state that the charges that they construct, or the charges they construct are not, they do not go beyond their particular initial condition that they look at. We've done something more akin to what this Kohler, Wolf, and Eckstein paper did, where we've constructed effective charges that appear to be conserved as an operator, although I think there are important differences because of the way they implement their perturbation theory. Now, the way one can understand why we can construct these types of charges is we can look at the basically the Taylor series expansion in time of the time derivative, this effective charge, this linear combination of Liebling-Linger charges. And this Taylor series takes this form where each term in the Taylor series involves higher order commutators with between the charge and the perturbation, which is then this one body cosine potential. And what we can show is that we can zero out a portion of each commutator order by order. And we can do so if under two conditions. If we restrict this zeroing out to the low energy Hilbert space, we can't zero out the entire commutator in the entire infinite dimensional Hilbert space, which again gets back to this notion that the KAM theorem breaks down when you have more and more degrees of freedom. So of course this construction of ours doesn't work if we consider arbitrarily high energy states. It only works if we consider zeroing out these commutators on the low energy Hilbert space. The other condition is that the perturbation that we consider has to be have a finite number of Fourier modes. If this, at least in our construction, if this cosine potential had an infinite number of Fourier modes, things wouldn't work.
For example, if you do quasi-periodic potential, it wouldn't work. If you do some Hoffman convention frequencies.
Hmm. Well, I think that would still be a finite. Well, no. If they were not commensurate with the system size, at least this construction, which is not to say some other construction couldn't work, but at least this construction wouldn't work. Now, if we, I think, if we did have an infinite number of Fourier modes, we would actually get something akin to what was found in this Maxime Olshani paper, where one saw very, very rapid crossover from integrability to quantum chaoticity when the perturbation was turned on. There was almost no, in this paper, they work an example where there's almost no memory of being close to an integrable point. And I think that's because they basically have a perturbation that has an infinite number of Fourier modes.
They find that there is this memory of integrability. So I don't think this whole Shani scenario is general necessary.
Okay. Wouldn't it depend on how rapidly the high frequency modes were represented?
Yes, I would agree so. But the example they work out a particular example, and they have some sort of back of the envelope calculations, and they show that you have very, very rapid thermalization. Although I guess I would say what you constructed was really a pre-thermalization plateau. Not, I think they're just looking at the infinite time limit. Or the statement I made about their paper applies only in the infinite time limit. Marcus should be here to defend this paper. They certainly haven't, they looked at really one example and then tried to draw broader conclusions. Whether those broader conclusions are universally valid, I would not want to say. So I've shown you this numerical construction of these effective charges. We can actually have a simple analytic construction of these same charges by what we do is we first we go back to this Taylor series and we focus on the first term in the Taylor series, this commutator between the cosine potential and the effective charge. And what we insist upon in constructing this effective charge is that if we take a state in the Lieb-Linegar basis, and each state in the Lieb-Linegar basis has a set of rapidities, which, as I told you, these sets of rapidities are determined by a set of quantum numbers. And these quantum numbers arise by when you solve the Beta-Ansatz equations. These are the Beta-Ansatz equations. If you write these Beta-Ansatz equations in logarithmic form, you get this, where each rapidity is determined by a quantum number, determined uniquely by a quantum number. So each state, these sets of rapidities are mapped onto a set of distinct quantum numbers. So what you do is you say, I'm going to zero out this commutator, all the matrix elements of this commutator involving states where the described by these quantum numbers that have that are less than some maximum quantum number. If a state has all of its quantum numbers less than some maximum quantum number, I'm going to choose my coefficients of my effective charge such that the linear combination vanishes. So you do so, and what one finds is that, well, at least in the general case, you need to use a large number of charges in order to create a charge such that this commutator vanishes on this low energy Hilbert space. And you see that the number of charges you need, well, this is an upper bound to the number of charges you need, but it goes basically as the maximum quantum number you're considering to the nth power, with n is number the number of particles in the system. Now you can ask yourself what happens at the next order in this Taylor series expansion. Suppose I've constructed this charge such that this commutator vanishes. At second order in the Taylor series, where I have to deal with the second order commutator, does this commutator have any memory of this zero? And the fact then it turns out that it does. That if I look at this commutator at second order in the perturbative expansion in the Taylor series expansion of the charge, you see that most of this block survives. It's only the edges that turn non-zero. So the edges of this block that turn non-zero are those involve those states where they involve quantum numbers between this maximum quantum number and basically the quantum the n max minus the integer describing the wavelength of the cosine potential. So and this procedure continues at third order. This block shrinks a little bit more, but provided we choose our maximum quantum large enough so that this zeroed block is large enough, we can ensure that there will be a zero block at any order in this Taylor series expansion. This is for the general case for the interaction parameter of the Bose gas being any value. For the C equals infinity case, things get a lot better, which is maybe not surprising because the C equals infinity case is actually integrable, although this we never use any of the integral structure of the C equals infinity case. But for the C equals infinity case, the number of charges you need as a function of this maximum quantum number becomes not some large power of the n max, but it just becomes n max divided by 2. And when you zero out this block of the first order, this zeroed out block actually survives to fourth order in the C equals infinity limit. And then every two orders that you go up, this block shrinks a bit, again by the integer representing the wavelength of the cosine potential. C is the interaction parameter. It's the strength of the delta function interaction in Liebling-Linegar. So it just measures. So C equals infinity. The bosons become like can be mapped on the free fermions. And then C equals zero, there's no interaction. So for the C equals infinity case, things are much better. So let me move to my conclusion since I'm out of time. So we were able to exploit our ability to describe the post-crunch dynamics in the Liebling-Linegar model out to long finite times. We were able to exploit this ability and construct various quasi-conserved quantities in the Liebling-Linegar model in an integrable broken Liebling-Linegar model setting. And we gave you both numerical and analytical arguments that this construction of these charges, these charges are actually conserved not just relative to this particular initial condition, but as operators, at least when restricted to the lower energy Hilbert space. Okay, thanks for your attention.
Yes.
So what exactly is the scaling of this number of charges?
As
with n number of particles. Is it unique exponentially? Is it growing exponentially?
Yeah, it's growing exponentially. Or exponentially like.
So you need to keep exponentially many charges to zero out.
Yeah.
So that does that affect the locality of it terribly or
well.
And why don't you see this
numerically? Because you just showed us
4 and 8.
I guess in part because the way this the analytic construction works, I mean, this should be thought of as an upper bound.
Okay.
This is the worst case scenario. And I mean, we're insisting that this entire block be zero. So that means we have to zero out each individual matrix element. And so that, no matter how small. Whereas when we construct the charges numerically, we are not, I mean, if there's some, I mean, effectively what we're doing, we're also zeroing out off-diagonal matrix elements. But the numerical construction is going to focus on the big off-diagonal matrix elements. If there's a small off-diagonal matrix element, it's not going to care. And so we wouldn't have to worry about that numerically. So the numerical construction will zero out, in effect, the big off-diagonal matrix elements first. And then as we go on, we would zero out the small off-diagonal matrix elements. But numerically, that wouldn't make any difference. So we see this. When we add a few charges numerically, we see the big improvement because we've gotten rid of the big off-diagonal matrix elements first, and then we get rid of the smaller ones so that we see this. But in this analytic construction, we're not making that.
So the analytic construction is more upper bound, but doesn't.
Yes. Yes.
Have you determined that you have enough eigenstates?
We do that because so we're interested in we have to have we expand out this initial condition in terms of these post-quench eigenstates, and we have to do it in such a fashion that the coefficients of each of the cosine eigenstate sums up. I mean, there has to be. We say we insist on say 99.5% overlap between the initial condition and these eigenstates. And if we consider too strong a quench where we have a very strong parabolic potential, then we wouldn't have a very good overlap between the cosine eigenstates and this initial condition. So the fact that we can only construct so many energy eigenstates in the cosine potential controls how strong this pre-quench state is perturbed, or how strong this trap is in the pre-quench Hamiltonian.
So would there be some kind of experimental signature of Clausian probability that gives an analogous to the Newton's cradle type?
Well, these conserved quantities that we construct are conserved, so any initial state would take on some value on these conserved quantities, which would have to be preserved in the more or less with the evolution of the state. So there is these quasi-conserved things should control the evolution in some fashion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, but the question is whether you would notice them by eye, so to speak, or whether you would have to do some very fancy, complicated construction to control them out.
Well, I mean, I guess in the initial experiment, if you pretended this parabolic, in the initial David Weiss experiment, if you pretended where this parabolic trap wasn't present and that you were just quenching, you were just releasing the system such that it was described purely by Lieb-Linegar, then you'd say, okay, it doesn't thermalize. But you wouldn't be able to necessarily see the action. It would be hard to tease out the action of the charges that were controlling this non-thermalization. What would be nice to do would be to show that these quasi-conserved quantities led to some sort of quasi-GGE, that they were at least controlling, say, the thermodynamic ensemble, controlling the long time dynamics of the gas in this cosine potential.
Right. I mean, what we basically claim, if you have this quasi-integrability, you get a pre-thermalization plateau. So your observable settles to some value, which is not thermal, for a very long period of time, and then eventually it goes off and thermalizes.
Yeah. Okay.
But there is a transient which can be very long, which would be dominated by this.
Although I don't know, I mean, I think these constructions of the charges are not so much a pre-thermalization plateau. I mean, these charges, I mean, the analytic construction is good for all times, so they would exist to all time. Yeah, no, I understand that. But I mean, I would think that there would be some quasi-GGE in terms of these effective charges that would control the long-time thermalization. Whether you want to say it's infinite time or just long time, that's a different detail. That's a detail.
Any other questions? No, it's